The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Wall Street Journal, News and Observer, and Religion News Service. First of all, from the Wall Street Journal, an article published on January 3rd entitled Benedict's Death Silences Conservative Church Voice by Francis X. Rucca, Rome. The death of Pope Benedict XVI has left conservative Catholics without their figurehead, amid deep divisions over how much the Church should adapt to the times or reaffirm its traditional teachings against the challenge of secularism. The retired Pope was, for more than three decades, a leader in the culture wars that have shaken the Catholic Church and wider society since the late 1960s. He was a living symbol, depending on one's point of view, of an intolerant and punitive religiosity or of stalwart fidelity amid disorienting change. Even during his last decade, after pledging his unconditional reverence and obedience to his more liberal successor, Pope Francis, Benedict remained a symbol of continuity for the Church's conservative currents. The end of the historically unique cohabitation of a present and former pope in the Vatican could exacerbate the tensions within the Church. Some in the Vatican saw Benedict's presence as useful for Francis. The Vatican in 2018 published comments by the retired pope that dismissed claims of differences with his successor as a matter of foolish prejudice and insisted on an interior continuity between the two. With the retired pope no longer around to issue such disclaimers, conservatives may feel less inhibited from speaking in his name to contest what they see as Francis' unwarranted innovations. On the other hand, Francis may feel free to move ahead even more boldly without concern for the feelings of the predecessor, whom he described as a wise grandfather. As Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the future pope gained wider fame as the Vatican's doctrinal chief under St. John Paul II from 1981 to 2005. He issued numerous documents reaffirming traditional teaching on matters including sexuality and bioethics, and rejecting innovations such as attempts to reconcile Marxism with the Gospels. The future pope also investigated, and in some cases censored, theologians for their deviations from orthodoxy. Cardinal Ratzinger's actions earned him the nicknames of God's Rottweiler, the Panzer Cardinal, and the Grand Inquisitor. But he unabashedly defended his role and that of the doctrinal office in the Ratzinger Report, a book-length interview that brought his ideas to popular attention when it was published in 1985. In a world in which, at bottom, many believers are gripped by skepticism, the conviction of the Church that there is one truth, and that this one truth can as such be recognized, expressed, and also clearly defined within certain bounds, appears scandalous, he said. Benedict was the first German to serve as pope in more than 1,000 years, yet he was an anomaly in his home country, where Catholic bishops and lay leaders are now calling for such liberal overhauls as women's ordination and the blessing of same-sex relationships. That tension was reflected in double-edged tributes from German political leaders immediately after the retired pope's death. Chancellor Olaf Scholz recalled him as an argumentative personality, and Finance Minister Christian Lindner described him as a not uncontroversial intellectual. The late pope was a lightning rod for criticism well beyond the Church. In 2008, Benedict canceled a lecture at Rome's La Sapienza University, a public institution, after his plans to speak there sparked protests from professors and students. who cited previous comments in which he had seemed to defend the Vatican's condemnation of the astronomer Galileo Galilei in the 17th century. Benedict was equally a hero to conservatives, who celebrated him as an eloquent critic of liberal tendencies within the church and beyond. Before his election as Pope, when he took his daily walks across St. Peter's Square between the doctrinal office and his nearby apartment, he was frequently approached by admirers seeking a word or a blessing, a former colleague said. Within the church, Benedict enjoyed special gratitude from devotees of the traditional Latin Mass, which had been practically eliminated in favor of worship in modern languages after the Second Vatican Council of 1962. As Pope, he lifted restrictions on use of the Latin Mass in 2007. That event changed the entire liturgical universe, said Ken Wolfe, who writes for traditionalist website Rorate Cayley. The centuries-old Mass went from something that had been relegated to the dustbin to something that the Pope was publicly promoting. But the move was highly contested, not least by Francis, who tightened restrictions on the Latin Mass in 2021 on the grounds that it had become a rallying point for opposition to the changes that followed Vatican II, as the council is known, and by implication, opposition to Francis' own progressive agenda. The Argentine Pope has emphasized social issues such as poverty, migration, and climate change over issues dear to conservatives, such as abortion, while adopting a more lenient approach on moral questions surrounding divorce, homosexuality, and conception. How Benedict's death will affect that agenda and the conservative opposition to it is now a major question, especially since no figure has yet emerged to succeed Benedict as a leader of conservative Catholics. Now an article from the Religion News Service published on the 19th of December and written by Claire Giangrave. Pope Francis reflects on his pontificate and legacy in latest interviews. Vatican City. Approaching his 10th year as pontiff, Pope Francis took time to address his legacy in two interviews, talking to Italian and Spanish reporters about what would happen if he were to fall ill and the role of retired popes. The Pope, who turned 86 on December 17th, said he didn't change a thing about how the role of the Pope Emeritus is defined. In 2013, Francis' predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, became the first pope to resign in 600 years, forcing the Church to invent the position of Pope Emeritus for the modern age. As he thought about his papacy, Francis de-emphasized his work on promoting the role of laity, especially women, and cleaning up the institution's notoriously corrupt finances. There's nothing to prevent a woman from guiding a dicastery in which a layman can be a prefect, the Pope said, adding that there might be a woman heading a Vatican department in the next 2 years. Francis said in the interview, published in the Spanish newspaper ABC, that he often visited his retired predecessor, who lived in a monastery at the Vatican, and that he found him in good spirits and lucid and praised him as one of the greats and a saint. In an interview aired the same day with the Italian TV channel Canal 5, Francis said cardinals who elected him at the 2013 conclave viewed Vatican financial reform as the key issue facing the next pope. The cardinals who were there helped me a lot in making these changes, he said, adding that now that aspect is strong. Francis has said in past interviews that he is open to resigning himself, and the interview with ABC, he confirmed there is already a plan should he fall victim to an illness or accident that impeded his ability to carry out his duties. I have already signed my renunciation, said the Pope, and that document is now in the hands of Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin. Francis said that Popes Pius XVII and Paul VI had informally established the practice of signing a provisional renunciation of the office in case of an extraordinary event. Reflecting on his legacy after a decade at the head of the Catholic Church, Francis said he was most proud of his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the gospel, the first major teaching he issued after becoming pope, laying out his vision for the church. Francis said that the document came from the heart and was heavily inspired by Pope Paul VI's 1975 Evangelii Nuntiado, proclaiming the gospel, and the Operosa Dei document that resulted from the 2007 Conference of Latin American Bishops. The Pope pointed also to the Synod on Synodality as a transformative change he will be known for. The worldwide consultation open to all Catholics to discuss and address the challenges facing the Church began in 2021 and is scheduled to end in two bishop summits at the Vatican in 2023 and 2024. The Pope said that in his previous synods, the media interfered with the discussion at the synod. He said the first one on family was to allow Holy Communion to be administered to divorcees. Actually, it was something much larger that included the possibility of a pastoral engagement with divorced people in the widest sense. With the Synod of the Amazon, the media said it was about whether they would ordain married men, he said. But he added, the Holy Spirit took things along a different path. Once again, Francis laid out his vision for the future of decision-making in the Church, which has as its center in the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit acts in two stages. First, he stirs things up, moves them around, and then he brings harmony, the Pope said. We must not forget this. If the Holy Spirit is not the main actor, it is not a synod, and we're still learning, he added. When it comes to the Vatican's foreign affairs, the Pope said he has maintained the institution's traditional stance of dialogue and diplomacy, even toward authoritarian states. The Holy See never leaves. It gets thrown out. It always attempts to save diplomatic relations and to save whatever can be salvaged through patience and dialogue, he said. The Pope said he has tried to be a bridge between opposing factions in the Ukraine war. The Pope has called for peace in Europe more than 100 times since Russia invaded Ukraine last February. We do whatever we can. They don't listen. What is happening in Ukraine is terrifying, he said, adding that he fears the conflict will not end soon. Let's not forget this. There are many hands stirring up the war pot. It is global. I think war is waged when an empire begins to weaken, and when there are weapons to be used, tested, and sold. There is a great deal at stake, he said. Now an article from the News and Observer, published on the 27th of December, entitled United Methodist Collective Helps Those Whose Churches Split, by Martha Quillen. As hundreds of United Methodist congregations in eastern North Carolina leave the denomination, thousands of members who disagreed with the disaffiliation process may find themselves spiritually adrift on Sunday mornings. The North Carolina Conference of the United Methodist Church is busy tossing out lifelines. We worried that with their churches disaffiliating, a lot of people may have felt that the Methodist Church had forgotten about them, said the Reverend Laura Whitman, pastor of a small startup church in Rocky Mount and a co-leader of the United Methodist Collective. We wanted them to feel that they were still a part of the United Methodist Church and that connection mattered. The North Carolina Conference, which covers the eastern half of the state, launched the collective after about a third of the churches in the conference decided to leave the denomination over whether to allow ordination of LGBTQ pastors and the celebration of same-sex weddings. The United Methodist Book of Discipline, which governs the denomination, doesn't allow the ordination of gay or lesbian pastors and doesn't recognize same-sex marriage. But some churches have allowed both without the denomination taking any action. The United Methodist Church is set to take up the matter at its denomination-wide meeting in 2024. But some congregations decided not to wait, and the denomination set rules allowing those churches to leave. Most are expected to join the new Global Methodist Church, where LGBTQ ordinations are not allowed and marriage is defined as being between one man and one woman. In the process, some members were disappointed that their churches didn't disaffiliate, and they may be looking for Global Methodist congregations or other theologically conservative congregations to join. In other cases, the congregation voted to disaffiliate, but some members disagreed, preferring to remain United Methodist or join another progressive church. Based on votes taken at churches that decided to leave, the conference has said that about 20% of the members of disaffiliating churches may be looking for another church home. It has been a bruising process in a denomination that has long celebrated the ability to bring people together in worship and ministry, even when they have strong disagreements. Whitman, a pastor for more than 15 years, said the process was made more brutal because it happened during the COVID-19 pandemic, when many people still are not attending church in person. Because we were not face-to-face with one another, I really think it affected how we communicated with and related to one another, Whitman said. Much of the discussion and argument took place on social media, including on Facebook pages of individual churches. You can stand behind a keyboard and say whatever you want to say, Whitman said. You will say things that you would not normally say to people you were in relationship with. The pandemic had a huge effect on the disaffiliation process, she said. When you're not face-to-face, it's very easy to other people. Whether it happened in person or online, Whitman said, many people have reported feeling a great loss if their church voted to disaffiliate and they disagreed. The biggest thing we heard was people needed a place to lament and share their grief. Some wanted to make sure they didn't lose connection to mission and ministry, the projects large and small that United Methodist churches do in communities across the state and the nation. But also, Methodists have also been a very connectional church, Whitman said, describing how when she started the Mills Church, an LGBTQ-affirming denomination in Rocky Mount, members of First United Methodist in town came over to help with construction. When a person leaves the church, sometimes having attended there for decades, Whitman said, you're not just losing your church, but you're losing that whole community. Right away, some members of disaffiliating churches who wished to stay with the United Methodist congregation were able to find new church homes nearby. On its website, the North Carolina Conference has an interactive map that lists United Methodist churches by district. Many churches also stream their services live on Facebook. The goal should be to get people where they are comfortable and can plug in and be part of the community, Whitman said, because that's what people are looking for, is a community within the church. You have to help them find those spaces where they feel it. Even before the NC conference voted in November to let churches disaffiliate, Highland United Methodist in Raleigh began sending out invitations to people within a four-mile radius of its building off Ridge Road. Pastor John Tyson said the church sent out 40,000 postcards in each of the past 3 months and will send another round in January. The church is about 5 miles from Asbury on Creedmoor Road, which is disaffiliating from the United Methodist and joining the Global Methodist Church. A couple of years ago, Highland voted to become a reconciling congregation, meaning it welcomes LGBTQ people for full inclusion in the church. As a result of the vote, Tyson said, about 20% of church members left. But since July 2022, he said, the church has seen about a 20% increase in attendance and a commensurate increase in financial pledges. Some came in response to the postcards that said, Highland UMC welcomes all. Tyson said that means everybody, rich, poor, old, young, straight, or gay, all races and ethnicities, including immigrants. In cities such as Raleigh, it will be relatively easy for people to find a new church. In other cases, Whitman said, so many congregations are left in an area that there are enough people to attend a church, and a new church form might help, with help from the collective, and Whitman hopes from other churches that can offer meeting space or other assistance. Four United Methodist chaplains in the collective are available to help with sacraments, such as communion, as groups try to launch new churches. For some displaced United Methodists, the process may take longer as they decide whether they want to stay in the denomination or if they will continue going to church at all. In the interim, they can move their memberships to the collective, which will hold them until they find another church home. While they're searching, the collective will hold some events online and may plan in-person events next year. Speculation by some that the United Methodist Church will die out as a result of the split is premature, Whitman said. I feel like we're on the cusp of some kind of revival or something within the church, she said. There's new life coming into the church, and church is not dead. I can tell you, as a church planner in a town that has more churches than any one place should, people are coming in, and some of them are the ones who said they never thought they would come to church. There is a future for the United Methodist Church. It's just going to take us having some growing pains over the next few years. Our last article is an excerpt from one published by the Religion News Service on the 19th of December, written by Jack Jenkins and entitled, William Barber Launches New Center at Yale, Will Retire from Church. Yale Divinity School is launching a new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy, an advocacy-based body to be led by prominent pastor and activist, the Reverend William Barber II. The goal of this center will be to prepare a new generation, what we call moral fusion leaders, that are going to be active in creating a just society, both in the academy and in the streets, Barber told RNS. Barber, a disciple of Disciples of Christ pastor and bishop with the Fellowship of Affirming Bishops, will begin teaching his first class at Yale with the start of the new semester in January. Though he'll be in and out of New Haven with another base in the South, Barber said the new role will require some changes, including his retirement as pastor from Greenleaf Christian Church in North Carolina, and a shifting of his duties with Repairers of the Breach, an advocacy organization he founded. Barber, who also co-leads the Poor People's Campaign, a modern resurgence of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s final campaign, has emerged as a prominent activist over the past decade, launching several major protest movements that have attracted attention from liberal leaders. He was a chief organizer of the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina in 2013, and with the Poor People's Campaign has staged sizable demonstrations across the country, focused on issues such as poverty and voting rights. A MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, Barber has also become a frequent speaker in religious and political circles alike, offering speeches at the Democratic National Convention, as well as delivering the sermon at President Joe Biden's inaugural prayer service in 2021. I want to share what I've learned, said Barber, who previously taught at schools such as Duke University and Union Theological Seminary. I believe one of the critical keys in the society is for pastors to understand how to be engaged in pastoral care, the priestly function of the pastorate, but also to be engaged in prophetic and public policy. All three of those things must go together. Barber, who has convened successful forums for presidential candidates in the past, noted the new Yale Center plans to organize a major gathering every 2 years. It will take place right during the middle of the presidential election, he said, and will bring together scholars, activists, and clergy. The goal of the event would be to assemble people who want to look at the real moral issues of this society, he said, insisting they would do so not from a partisan perspective, but from our deepest moral perspective. The center will also feature a liaison based in the South, tasked with establishing a partnership with historically Black colleges and universities in the region to help connect students with the organization's programs. Barber said he drew inspiration from a similar effort organized in the mid-20th century by prominent public theologians such as Howard Thurman and Reinhold Niebuhr. In a statement, Yale Divinity School Dean Greg Sterling said he was thrilled to welcome Barber to the school. Dr. Barber's work and service is in the tradition of public witness that produced Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, Walter Rauschenbusch and Howard Thurman, Ida B. Wells and Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr., Ella Baker, and Abraham Joshua Heschel, Sterling said. Establishment of the center at Yale is an opportunity to deepen our relationship to a historical movement that revives nearly two centuries of social justice tradition to meet the complex and social realities of our time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.